Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome you all to our oral arguments today. First is 10 AP 2273 CR, State versus John Anthony Soto. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Soto is Assistant State Public Defender Chandra Harvey. Ms. Harvey? You may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Chandra Harvey, and I represent the defendant appellant, John Anthony Soto. This court has been asked to decide whether Wisconsin Statute 971.041, which demands a defendant's physical presence at his guilty plea hearing, is violated where, as here, the presiding judge conducts the hearing via video teleconferencing technology from a courtroom other than the one at which the defendant appears. I respectfully ask that this court answer yes for the following two reasons. First, the plain language of 971.041 establishes a clear procedure which requires a defendant to be physically present at the guilty plea hearing. And second, that procedure and the right it confers on the defendant cannot be waived, even if the waiver is knowing and voluntary. Both of these matters are questions of law which this court reviews independently and without deference to the lower courts. In this case, the presiding judge conducted Mr. Soto's guilty plea hearing from the Jackson County Courthouse. However, Mr. Soto, along with defense counsel and the attorney for the state, appeared at the Trempealeau County Courthouse. Communication between the two locations appeared via video teleconferencing. This scenario violated well-established law.
Was Mr. Soto able to drive to the other courthouse? Was he in custody? Was there something that would preclude him? I mean, he's the only one who knows he's going to plead, right? Sure. I mean, did he give the judge a heads up, I'm going to plead today, and so do an order for appearance or require my appearance or, you know, I need you to be where I am or I need to be where you are? The judge can't make him plead. The DA can't make him plead. He's the only one who can decide that. So why didn't he go to where the judge was if this was going to be an issue later?
Well, Your Honor, I believe Mr. Soto appeared in the Trempealeau County Courthouse, which was where this case was brought. So this was a Trempealeau County case.
Okay, but my point is, you know, I'm existing in the world of reality, okay? And when you have a judge who is in a different county but sitting and assigned to a case, the judge probably wouldn't have a problem. I mean, I've done that before, where some of the hearings are conducted in Washington County and others are conducted in the other county, and some of them are done by phone and some of them. But the judge isn't going to know he's going to plead. So if the judge's appearance, are you saying the judge's appearance in Trempealeau County was mandatory? Do you think this would have been an okay plea if he would have taken the plea in Judge Lister's county?
It is my opinion that the judge was supposed to be in the Trempealeau County Courthouse along with the defendant and the attorneys. To answer your other questions, I'm not certain whether there was something that would have precluded Mr. Soto from going to the Jackson County Courthouse. I do know from the record that that certainly wasn't an option or an alternative which was made known to Mr. Soto.
Okay, so did Mr. Soto say, hey, judge, I'm going to enter a plea, and I don't want to do this by video conferencing? Or, judge, I know you're going to be here. I intend to enter a plea. Or was it a last-minute decision? Or how did it go down? Explain the reality of it so I know what we can tell circuit court judges they need to do. I mean, maybe the answer is at every hearing you shouldn't allow an order for appearance. Or at every hearing, you shouldn't allow video conferencing, because at any point, a defendant can decide to plead. So help me out. What's the rule for judges on when, what should the judge have done? oh, you're on video conferencing, wait a minute, let me drive the 2 hours to you, or wait a minute, you drive here and I'll have your hearing at 3 this afternoon? I mean, do you think it would have been defective if he had to drive to Jackson?
I don't think that necessarily would have been time effective, and I understand Your Honor's concern in that regard. However, there are a number of other options which the court could have undertaken to accommodate the need for physical presence. For example, they could have stayed the hearing, tried to reschedule it, and tell a time where all the parties could be present.
Sure, but then maybe he changes his mind and doesn't want to plead. I mean, is this a final status before trial?
I'm not sure if this was the final status right before trial. I do know that in this case, it's likely that the judge was aware that there was going to be a plea entered prior to the hearing actually starting. Usually, counsel will file various documents, including the plea waiver and questionnaire form, with the judge. So the judge did have that in advance. And the discussions about whether or not this hearing should occur via video didn't even occur until the start of the until that hearing, when the judge had already made a decision not to appear.
Okay, but let me just chunk this out and ask one question. If the judge said, fine, you're entering a plea, I have a busy calendar, I will accommodate you, come to Jackson County today, and I'll take your plea, do you think that would have been defective for the judge in a different county to take the plea in the Trempealeau County case? Physical presence is there, just it happens in a different county. Do you think that would be defective?
Just to make sure that I understand you correctly, you're saying if the parties were physically present together in the same courtroom, would that have been defective?
If they were in the Jackson County Courthouse courtroom, physically present for the plea to be entered, do you think that would be defective?
I'm not sure if there's anything that would bar them from having the plea occur in the Jackson County Courthouse versus the Trempealeau County Courthouse. I'm not certain if there's something that would bar that. But from the issue of this case, from the language of 971.041, which in my opinion demands that the parties be together in a singular courthouse, then that wouldn't be defective under that particular law.
So in the future, you're saying what a judge should do is say, all right, I understand you're going to enter a plea today. I'm going to adjourn this, ask that you drive here and be physically present so we don't have any issues under the statute, and I'll take your plea in person. You can't waive it. There can't be any other way to do this. You must drive here today.
Yes,
that would cure this problem.
The position that I'm advocating is that whenever the defendant chooses to enter a guilty plea, that must occur in person. I do think that it might be problematic to require the defendant to drive to be with the judge. In my personal opinion, it's the judge's obligation to be in the courthouse where the defendant is, in the county where the crime has been charged. I believe that it would be possibly burdensome to force the defendant, particularly an indigent one who's in custody, to move to
is
that other county.
Is he indigent in custody?
Yes.
Did he do an order for appearance then? Was there an order for appearance? Because that can be done, where the judge can arrange someone who's in custody to appear, and then you don't have sheriff's deputies, or maybe you do, but did he say, oh, gosh, my appearance is necessary for this plea? He can't decide to check himself out of the jail. Obviously, a judge needs to do an order for appearance. Did he do that here?
I would assume so, because Mr. Soto was, in fact, in a courtroom. He just wasn't, he wasn't in the jail. He was in a courtroom. He just wasn't in the same courtroom as the presiding judge.
Okay, so he was in custody.
Yes.
He was not out released in any way. He was escorted by sheriff's deputies into the Trempealeau County courtroom, and video conferencing occurred from there.
He was in the Trempealeau County courthouse, yes. And there was a video conferencing connection that courthouse.
He went from jail. I don't want to take up all the time.
I can verify that.
He went from jail into the courtroom and then back to jail. So he was in custody. He would have needed an order for appearance.
Let me quick verify that just to make sure that I give you the correct information. The The transcript that I have doesn't specify for sure whether or not he was in custody. It merely specifies that the hearing occurred via video teleconferencing. So I am not absolutely certain of that fact.
Okay. All right. And the CCAP record would probably show that.
They would indicate that, yes.
But no order for appearance was done saying, you know, we're going to enter a plea, please transport us, or judge, reschedule it so you can be present.
I'm sorry, no order was entered saying that.
All right,
Ms. Harvey, I've got a couple of questions. One of the things you said as you started your argument was that this is something that could not be waived by the defendant. Why do you say that there could not be a waiver or a forfeiture here?
Your Honor, in State versus Koopmans, this court expressly held that a defendant's physical presence cannot be waived, even if the waiver is knowing and voluntary. To reach that decision, the court looked to the plain meaning of the word shall, which occurs in 971.041, and concluded that presence was not just a right, but a procedure that is incumbent upon the courts. The court also found that if presence was deemed waivable, then the two exceptions to 971.041 would be rendered meaningless. Those two exceptions provide that presence can be waived in misdemeanor proceedings and if a defendant who is initially present at the start of his trial then voluntarily absents himself. So the court relied on the rule of statutory interpretation that any exception not provided for has to be excluded. So therefore, the court concluded that waiver cannot occur outside of those two narrowly defined exceptions.
Okay, but now after you have the Koopmans case, it's my understanding that you have enactment of 885-60, 2A, which is the section that would be applicable here. Doesn't that change the equation somewhat?
Your Honor, I don't believe so. Wisconsin Statute 88560 addresses the use of video conferencing in criminal proceedings.
Right.
Its language is quite clear that 2A mandates in relevant parts that a defendant is entitled to be physically present at all critical stages, including the guilty plea hearing. As noted in this court's comments to the rule, that statute, that provision, was intended to preserve rather than infringe upon the defendant's existing rights of presence. So that routes the question back to 971.041, which mandates that they have to be together, which Koopmans then in turn says that provision can't be waived.
But now you've got, in this particular case, the judge who's in Jackson County saying to the defendant and the defendant's attorney in Trempealeau County, do you have any objection to the use of video conferencing in regard to these proceedings? And both the attorney for the defendant and Mr. Soto, the defendant, say that there's no objection. What is that? Isn't that significant in all of this? Significant especially in light of 885.60?
Your Honor, I don't believe that's necessarily significant. First of all, regardless of whether the defendant objected or not, if the rule is that waiver cannot be permitted, then the defendant's failure to object or his counsel's failure to object would be irrelevant. However, in the alternative, if this court were to find that waiver, that a defendant could waive the procedure that's mandated by 971.041, it seems to me that the court should also hold that waiver can only be achieved if it's knowing and voluntary. Although the record in this case suggests that the defendant did not object, there's nothing in the record which indicates that Mr. Soto was aware that he had a right to be physically present, that he was aware of the language of 971.041, that he was aware that there were alternatives to the use of video teleconferencing equipment. And alternatively, the court also failed to ask Mr. Soto any questions which would satisfy the court that his decision to waive his presence was knowing and voluntary.
Is this necessarily a waiver? You know, this court over the last several years, starting, I think, with Nadina, but with several other cases as well, has drawn a distinction between waiver and forfeiture. And quite obviously, in a waiver situation, it would appear from what we've said that there has to be a colloquy, that there has to be a knowing action taken by the defendant. Forfeiture seems to be looser, if you will. In a forfeiture situation, it's basically a failure to object. As I looked at what occurred here, what struck me was this is almost like a hybrid situation. It's a little bit like waiver. It's a little bit like forfeiture. What do you think it is? Do you think it's clearly waiver here? And why not, if you think it's clearly waiver, why not forfeiture?
Your Honor, I believe that this is a case that's clearly about waiver and not about forfeiture for a couple of reasons. First, there is the language we have from Koopmans, which already says that. But putting that aside, it's important that we recognize that 971.041 has its roots in the Sixth Amendment, which is obligatory on the states via the 14th Amendment. In general, Sixth Amendment rights have been deemed so important that they can't simply be forfeited. If waiver is permitted at all, in all of these cases, it must be knowing and voluntary and on the record. But even if we set aside those constitutional underpinnings, this court has previously held that whenever a statute creates a right, that right can only be waived if the waiver is knowing and voluntary.
Are you relying on Koopman?
I'm sorry?
Are you relying on Koopman for that?
No, it's, I want to say it is, hang on, let me quick.
Your statement was the statutory right only be waived by a voluntary and knowing.
Yes, I believe it is. Hang on, let me put it on my notes. It is Faust versus Ladysmith Hawkins School System.
Citation.
One more second.
It may be in your brief, and I'll check it there.
It's in my brief, but I can have it for you in just 1 second.
I can find it.
Citation is 88 Wiss 2nd 525. In that case, though, the particular facts of that case involved a teacher's procedural right to a preliminary hearing before a decision not to renew her contract had become final. In my opinion, the guilty plea hearing is far more grave than this preliminary non-renewal hearing. Well, that hearing could have resulted in the loss of that teacher's employment. The guilty plea hearing results in a loss of liberty, and I think it calls, therefore, for heightened rather than diminished procedural protections. So based on those holdings and based on the constitutional underpinnings, I do think that this is a case of waiver, not of forfeiture.
I'd like to get to some basics here. One, 885, whatever it is, on video conferencing is a rule of the court. It's in the statute book, but it's not a legislative enactment. The court has authority under 751.12 to do rules relating to pleading practice and procedure. So I don't have any problem with the court's power to do video conferencing rules. Do you?
No.
Okay. 751.12 says, quote, which is the Supreme Court's power to enact rules, the rules shall not abridge, enlarge, or modify substantive rights of any litigant. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me you should be arguing that, and maybe you do indirectly, that 885 cannot abridge, enlarge, or modify substantive rights. And the substantive right, which I hear you talking about, is 971.04. And that is a statute. Now, if you look at the legislative history, at least since 1971, it shows both statutes and Supreme Court orders relating to the presence of the defendant. Now, I did check that out, and the statute 971.04.1, except for C, which is during voir dire, is as statutorily enacted. So we don't have a situation of two rules. We have, in your case, a situation of a rule, 885, and a statute, 97104. So this court cannot enlarge, bridge, and modify, right? Okay. So your argument is the statute says present. Present means physically present. Yes. Well, the statute doesn't say physically present, but your argument is that Koopman and, what was your other case, Peters. Peters has a little problem, too, because it was overruled, and the relevance of an overruled Court of Appeals decision is probably not high, if any,
right,
under the court. So you're left with Koopman. Koopman is a case where the defendant disappeared. He did not come to sentencing, right?
Right.
And I recognize that Koopman has a very broad holding. It says, we hold that a defendant may not waive his or her statutory right to be present at sentencing, even if the waiver is made knowingly and voluntarily. Well, that's a little broad for the fact situation in that case, isn't it? A better holding that fit the fact situation would have probably been that maybe a disappearing fugitive doesn't constitute knowing involuntary waiver sufficient to do away with his right to be present. But we got other cases where you got a fugitive from who voluntarily leaves, and what does he forfeit or waive his rights? And cases are not quite clear on that. So you're relying on a case, Koopman, that dealt with true absence. I mean, this guy was not only not in court, no one knew where he was. And our case here is dealing with somebody who is physically present somewhere in some court. So I have a little trouble with the bases for your saying that there's authority that present means physically present. And what are we going on, A, or is it 971041A, arraignment?
For the basis that presence means physically present.
What procedure here are we talking about under A through H?
There's I believe Your Honor has asked a number of questions, and right. So I'll try to sort them all out.
I figured I'd get it in while I had the microphone.
You can direct me back on point if you think I'm answering the wrong one. But there's a couple things I think that I need to touch on. First, Your Honor has expressed concern about does present mean physically present if Koopman's is of questionable validity.
Right.
This court has held, and the state has actually conceded in its brief, that present does mean the right to be physically present in the courtroom, and that is based on this court's holding in State versus Veneman, which is at 180 Wis Second 81.
All right.
On top of that, numerous jurisdictions, although it isn't as clear whether Wisconsin has a similar holding, but the majority of jurisdictions that have dealt with this particular issue have, relying on everyday dictionary definitions, have clarified that physical presence cannot be achieved unless the defendant appears in the same location as the judge. From a dictionary difference or definition, present means in the same place. And so I think from a plain language analysis, that is also straightforward. Second, Chief Justice, you asked whether Supreme Court rules can abridge, modify, or
enlarge substantive rights.
And it is my opinion that would not be the case. That certainly wasn't the court's intent in this case. If you look to comment 2008, the court specifically says that it's the intent of the court and of this rule, 885.60, to preserve the rights that litigants already have, to keep them the same, to not infringe upon them. And so from that standpoint, I believe absolutely 885.60 should not be read in a way which would overrule or interfere with the clear language of 971.041.
Well, I don't care about the clear language as much as that cannot interfere with a substantive right.
Right.
It is outside the power of this court.
Right.
Okay. We agree on that.
Yes.
Question is, what's the substantive right here?
Well, the substantive right is twofold. First, as I've alluted to, 971.041 has got these constitutional underpinnings. There is federally a recognized constitutional right to be present that's based in the Sixth Amendment on the Confrontation Clause, among several other aspects of the Sixth Amendment as well. And so there is that component to it. But it's clear that 971.041 also tries to create a substantive statutory right.
Okay.
It also creates a mandatory procedure, as clear bright line rule to guide courts, saying here is when a defendant's presence is required and here is when it's not. So there's three different components to that, and I believe that none of those should be abridged.
Counsel, I have one quick question for you.
Sure.
Does it matter at all that this defendant was in a courtroom with his attorney present and with the prosecutor present, rather than being in a jail where sometimes you do use video conferencing?
Your Honor, I believe it doesn't matter at all. If presence is defined as physical presence and presence is defined as being in the same place as the judge, that clearly wasn't satisfied on the facts of these case. And so I don't believe it matters at all. But whether the defendant is located in the jail or whether he is located in the courtroom, there are certain harms that are absolutely inherent in the use of video conferencing technology. It doesn't matter where the defendant is. Those harms are going to remain the same. I'll just briefly touch on a couple of those.
Because your red light's on, counsel.
Oh, yes, it is.
You may touch briefly.
Okay. So there's a number of concerns that I have here. First, in this case, the trial court asserted without any evidence that all the parties were able to see and hear everything clearly. That's not supported by the record. The record indicates Mr. Soto was only able to see the judge. He wasn't able to see if the victim was with the judge, the public, the media, a court reporter, so on and so forth. More importantly, as former Chief Justice Warren said, the courtroom is the most important aspect of the proceeding. It's a setting. The setting that the courtroom provides is itself an important element in the constitutional conception of the trial, contributing a dignity essential to the integrity of the process. And so it creates this atmosphere of solemnity. It helps people view the defendant, view the judge as real people with real rights in limbo. And that is compromised.
Even though he was in a courtroom, it has to be a courtroom with the judge to count.
Absolutely.
Okay. Justice Prosser has a question for you.
Sure.
Ms. Harvey.
Counsel, you have made reference to 885.60.
Yes.
And including the comment.
The comments.
All right. Are you familiar with 885.62?
Yes.
What does 885.62 say?
Oh, 62. It says parties to circuit court proceedings may waive the technical and operational standards provided in this chapter or may stipulate to any different modified procedure as may be approved by the court. To me, that goes to the actual, like, technological capabilities of the equipment. For example, a camera might not have a zoom feature that might be required by the court, but the defendant could say, that's okay, as long as there's, you know, a camera that's still working, that's what matters. So that's the way that I interpret that provision.
It doesn't apply to any waiver of a right to be present?
The language, Your Honor, I believe the language is quite narrow. It says may waive the technical and operational standards. That has to do with the way the equipment functions, not the defendant's presence. And so I believe that a defendant is still absolutely required to be present in those hearings specified by 971.041, if it's a hearing where his presence isn't mandatory and video teleconferencing is used, if that equipment isn't quite up to par with the level that this court has deemed appropriate, the defendant in that case would be able to say, that's okay, we'll go ahead with that anyway.
So are you saying then that 971.04, if that didn't exist and we were operating only under 885.60, that the defendant couldn't waive his presence in certain proceedings?
Well, there's this broader constitutional issue, which isn't technically before the court. It wasn't briefed at this stage, but that would be another consideration for the court. Regardless of what 885.60 says, there are concerns, I believe, about the constitutionality of that and whether it would fringe with that federally mandated right of presence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Maura Whalen, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin. Ms. Whalen.
May it please the court. I just want to respond to one of the last things discussed, which has to do with the allegation of prejudicial error because the defendant didn't know whether there were any unknown spectators in the courtroom with the judge. This argument is meritless because, first of all, it was waived. It was not raised in the post-conviction motion.
Waived or forfeited, counsel. Take care.
Thank you. Forfeited because this is an argument that could have been raised in post-conviction proceedings, in which case the judge could have answered as a factual matter whether there were absent spectators, and we wouldn't be talking about that right now. Moreover, Soto fails to explain why the presence of unknown spectators would be prejudicial. This was a guilty plea hearing. The important considerations were whether Soto entered his plea knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily, and whether he received effective assistance of counsel. He doesn't explain how the presence of unknown persons would affect those interests. Going to the beginning of my argument, I think the threshold question is whether 885.60 permits a defendant to plead guilty voluntarily by video conference. And this is a court rule, of course, so I think we can only guide you and try to convince you what you meant, but I really think you're going to know what you meant, so.
Well, one thing we couldn't have meant is to change substantive law.
By which you mean you couldn't, through 885.60, amend 971.04.
Shall not abridge, enlarge, or modify substantive rights. So if you view a 971.04 as a substantive right, statutory substantive right to be present, we can't amend or enlarge or abridge that.
Well, my answer is Veneman, and not the strict holding in Veneman, but the reasoning behind Veneman.
Okay, now Veneman was a teleconference, right?
Correct. And this court...
And...
I'm sorry.
There was a telephone statute, right?
Correct.
Which had a list of proceedings where telephone was allowed, right?
Correct.
And it didn't include the proceeding in Veneman.
Correct.
Correct? Okay.
And what this court's analysis of the interplay between 971.041 and 967.08 and the procedure before it was to conclude that the 971.041 barred the defendant's telephone appearance because the telephone statute did not expressly provide for a telephone appearance. And I infer from...
Not a statute. Wasn't there a rule, too?
Exactly.
Okay.
And so that was part of where I was going, and I just checked the statute books that 967.08, like 885.60, was a court rule, and if the court thought that 967.08 could make an exception to strict literal physical presence, so could 885.60. And it's important that what Veneman was saying is how do you define physical presence is tied up with the interpretation of the statutes. And what Veneman was saying is that telephone presence can't be physical presence because the telephone statute doesn't allow it to be. It is a hybrid situation, just like today's situation is. And so I think that, therefore, 885-60 can not deprive the defendant of his right to be physically present, but add a nuance to what physical presence means under the combined statutes of 97104 and 885-60.
Veneman says, quote,
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Veneman says, quote, we hold that 971041, which is exactly the statute we're dealing with, applies only to pretrial, trial, sentencing, and judgment phases. And it is inapplicable to post-conviction evidentiary hearings brought under another statute. And in Veneman, that was the case. It was a post-conviction. Mm-hmm. So 97104 did not cover it, according to the holding of this case. It then went on to said, nevertheless, since the evidence offered at Veneman's post-conviction evidentiary hearing raised substantial issues of facts as to events in which he had participated, his physical presence was required, citing Hatch and the United States versus Amon. So Veneman is also a very narrow fact case that's not the same as here. In Veneman, you had one, 97104 didn't cover. You agree that 97104.1 covers the proceeding here? Is it arraignment?
I think it's a tricky question, and it's actually only Peters specifically answers that question. And in a footnote in my brief, and I think the Soto tries to set this out too, why is this even covered by 104? And I think that we're looking to a combination of... I think to me the most pertinent subsection is at the pronouncement of judgment.
Okay.
I think that Soto argues that, as I recall, that you could also look to evidentiary hearing. I think it's distinguishable but plausible because the court goes through the factual basis. Mm-hmm. But I think that the most it's pronouncement of judgment that seems the most applicable. Mm-hmm. But guilty plea hearing is not explicitly mentioned in the presence statute. I mean, that's...
Think it's constitutionally required?
No. And I think that even though this was an issue that was abandoned by Soto, I did discuss at length in my brief why it was not constitutionally required.
He has to be present, though, if you're going to enter a guilty plea, no?
He has to be present in
some sense.
Some form, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And
that's
I think that when if you... Think about in any of, I mean, just looking, say, at the provisions in 97104, if you think of why is it important for a defendant to be present at any given time, why can't we just mail in a guilty plea hearing, a guilty plea form? And I think that the reason is that we really want to know that the defendant voluntarily, intelligently, and knowingly waived his right to be tried and to put the state to its proof, and that we can step back and say, well, in this kind of hybrid present, not totally present, face-to-face proceeding, is that presence interest satisfied? And I think that we can just look at this case and any other case presided over by a judge who's doing a good job, that the interest in ensuring the defendant's knowing, intelligent, I wish we had, you know, an abbreviation, a VIK waiver, and that we can see he's been effectively represented, that the presence interest is satisfied.
Counsel, let me get a couple of facts straight. Back in May of 2009, it looks like the information was filed. That was after the preliminary hearing. Then the arraignment occurred on May 15, 2009. And then there was a notice sent out that there would be a status conference after July 2nd, 2009. Strikes me, based upon just what's in CCAP, which is public record, that there must have been some negotiation or something that occurred between that time period. And if it's in the record, let me know that. If it's not in the record, fine. But I only say that because on the 8th of July at the plea hearing, that's where the defendant entered a plea, not to the information, but an amended information. So what would cause the state to file an amended information? Possibly plea negotiations, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not, but maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And a plea questionnaire is filed. He waived his rights, and the court found that he waived his rights. He pled guilty to count 5 of the amended information, and the court found him guilty of that one count, but counts 1, 6, and 7 were dismissed outright.
Mm-hmm.
Counts 2, 3, and 4 were dismissed but read in.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a PSI order, and it was sent over for a sentencing hearing. I only raise that because typically that's not something that's just drafted up in court, an amended information and an agreement about dismissing and reading in several counts and outright dismissal of other counts. I mean, typically that's something that at least a lawyer and a defendant and a DA might talk about because it's not going to happen without there being some consensus reached. Of course, the defendant doesn't have to enter a plea until ultimately the judge takes the plea from the defendant. But for all that to happen, I'm just thinking, at some point, could someone have said, judge, we need an order for appearance here because there's going to be a plea on the state. Or, judge, there have been serious negotiations. You need to schedule this for when you're going to be present. Is there anything in the record to indicate that the judge is given any sort of heads up that we really want to be in the same physical room as you? So that can't happen. And I looked back. I mean, it looks like he was in on $250,000 cash bond, and he had a public defender, so I think it's reasonable to assume he was probably in on this case. But is there anything in the record to indicate, you know, that the judge was aware of this idea that they wanted physical presence of the judge in the same courtroom with this defendant, this lawyer, and this DA?
Not that I know of.
Okay, fair enough.
I assume, like you do in your question to me as opposed to your question to opposing counsel, that this was probably not a last-minute decision. It was interesting to me when you were asking about that because just in going through these records over the years, it seems it's almost always something that the parties know before they walk into the courtroom that the defendant is going to plead guilty. So what I would assume that. But I think that if the underlying question is, if the parties knew what was going on, why didn't they arrange for the defendant's physical presence in the same courtroom with the judge? I assume the answer is because they thought that this was fine under 885-60.
Counsel, I'd like to return to 885-60 and also the case law. It seems to me, and this is where I need help with your argument, that you're suggesting that 885 has indeed modified substantive law. On page 22 of your brief, with regard to your discussion in Veneman, you indicate that at the very top,
that the legal imprimatur, which I assume is the change in 885-60, gives this court, given by this court, to the use of such technology in judicial proceedings. I'm reading from the very top. You don't necessarily need to get it in your brief if you don't want. Call for a fresh consideration of the meaning of physical presence under Venema. Mm-hmm. And then on the very next page, on page 23, you contend that the Koopman rule, reading from the very beginning of the first full paragraph, the first sentence, the Koopman's rule is not workable in the post-885.60 courtroom. I read your brief as saying, in those two pages particularly, and in discussing Veneman and Koopman's, that 885.60 must cause us to modify or give fresh consideration to the holding of Veneman, and that Koopman's can't coexist, is not workable, given what the court rule 885.60 says. If that's your argument, it sure seems like you're suggesting that this rule modifies substantive law and needs us to modify or overrule Koopman's and modify Veneman. So can you help me with that?
Okay. Well, with Veneman, I mean, I have, I think, an easier answer to that. It's really what I started out with. I think that Veneman said if 967-08, a court rule, had allowed a telephone appearance in this post-conviction evidentiary hearing kind of thing, we would allow that telephone appearance and we would consider that present under 97104. But the telephone proceedings statute didn't allow that kind of appearance, so therefore the use of that in this, in the Veneman case, violates 97104. I think you apply that same reasoning to 885.60 and say, ask, does 885.60 allow a video conference appearance in these proceedings? If so, then it's permissible under 974.041. If 885.60 does not allow that kind of appearance, it's not permissible.
Then allowing that kind of appearance is not a substantive right in your argument, I assume, because it can't modify a substantive right.
Well, it's
it's a problem. Get the Koopman's.
Okay. Well, Koopman's.
Let me go back to Veneman. Go back to Veneman. Your argument would be very persuasive to me if that was the only holding of Veneman.
Okay.
Veneman carefully had three holdings.
Right, yeah.
And the three holdings, the third one is a, anyway, telephone conferencing rule doesn't cover. But its holding says 97104 applies pretrial trial sentencing judgment. That was its first holding, which was for reading of the statute. Second holding is that it applies anyway, physical presence applies to an evidentiary hearing post-conviction, which is not covered by the statute. And so here the question is whether this would be an evidentiary hearing covered by the statute anyway. So you're trying to limit Veneman to just the third holding on telephone conference and ignore the others.
Yeah, well, I guess because I think that's the relevant holding to this case.
Right.
And so I think my mind is unable to reconsider how the first two things are. I mean, I think that that's, to me, what is pertinent for Veneman today.
Okay.
I mean, I agree with your points on the first two, but...
Okay.
So with Koopman's...
Well, I am curious. I know you're going to talk about Koopman's and the fact that there was a sentencing in absentia where the defendant was not present in any sense. But what I'd like to do is get back to what you started to answer in response to Justice Bradley's question, in regard to the substantive right here.
Mm-hmm.
And you seem to pause or hesitate in the midst of responding to the question whether the right to be physically present during the plea colloquy is a substantive right. Now, you may have tangentially responded to that, and I've been listening very carefully to see how that question corresponds to the constitutional rights which we're talking about and must consider as to the right of the defendant to enter a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent plea and the duty of the circuit court judge to determine whether that plea has been so entered. With all of that as backdrop, I would like to hear your more comprehensive response to whether that right to be physically present is a substantive right.
I think that the right to be present is a substantive right, and that's under 970.104. And the word in 970.104 is present. The court in Veneman interpreted what present means. And the court in Veneman concluded that when, in the specific context of someone appearing from a jail by telephone conference when he got cut off three or four times and said, I can't hear, and there's all this noise, the court in that time, and that was 1993, I think, said, aside from my statutory analysis, said that that kind of appearance does not constitute physical presence. I think that I am not urging today that this court interpret 885-60 as modifying or abridging the substantive right of presence. What I can't do that. It's the law is totally against me. What I am asking the court to do is to reconsider what presence means under a framework where the court itself has provided this new means of litigation practice, which is, by the way, helpful to all the classes of judges, the classes of defendants, and the classes of prosecutors. Now, in any given case, one of those parties may say, I don't like this, but the three groups are all benefited by this. And then in terms of Koopmans, I think that if...
And I have nothing against you talking about Koopmans, but I want
to... Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
I want to just follow up. You urge that interpretation against a factual background of one where it doesn't seem to be that anyone is disputing that the judge in this case, the trial court judge, could see and hear Mr. Soto. True?
Yes.
There doesn't seem to be any dispute that the video teleconferencing system worked as it was intended.
Yes. I think, you know, we hear this phrase about bad facts make bad law. Here we have good facts. I mean, I feel that there's almost, that the problem with this case for future cases is that that this is almost such a pristine setup that it still leaves other questions unanswered.
Well, let me see if, I'm sorry, do you have a question?
Well, I was
finished.
Just going to give her an opportunity to talk about Koopmans, but if you have a different question.
No, I do. This is all in response to one's substantive rights, and as Justice Bradley looked at your brief. But what I hear you saying is to hold for the state, we'd have to look at Veneman and Koopman, and you'll get to Koopman, and maybe not overrule them, but tweak, tinker with, do something with language in those cases and perhaps others, where we define a statute, we interpret a statute with the word present to mean physically present.
Mm-hmm.
That if we're going to stay with those cases that say physically present, we've got a problem with video conferencing. Mm-hmm.
and the cases have to be tweaked to say video conferencing constitutes presence under 97104, at least for G. And then if we say that, my next question to you, if you agree that it has to be tweaked, which I keep hearing and which your brief says, not using those words, but in effect saying it, then the question is whether we can video conference an evidentiary hearing, a view by the jury, trial, voir dire. Because it seems to me that the word present is used in all of them, and maybe the state will say it has a different meaning for each of them.
Okay, talking about Koopmans is easier. But
I know it's easier.
I think that...
Do you have to tweak the other cases? That's my first question.
Well, I think when we think back to Veneman and saying present means physically present, what we need to do is work on defining what physically present means, what physically means. Because, I mean, it was actually difficult to prepare my argument or write the brief because, you know, do my saying face-to-face, which was a problem in a previous case I had, but... I was going to say, okay, they're physically present means face-to-face. Well, no, because a video conference, it's face-to-face. In person, well, that's sort of repetitive. I think that all Veneman says is physically present. Present means physically present, and someone who's appearing by telephone under circumstances not envisioned by the statutes is not physically present. So I think what you have to do under 885.60 is determine, as Justice Judge Hoover, or maybe it was the majority opinion in the reversed Peters said, you know, a video conference appearance may be the legal equivalent of physical presence. So it's not present you have to redefine and sort of or tweak. It's physically. And so the question is whether... That now,
we added physical to the statute, in effect, or defined presence as physical.
885.60.
Okay. And 97104.
Okay.
Now, you have
right,
to be
but,
careful.
But what does physically mean? Because
all right.
We've got two courtrooms, and the defendant and the judge are in courtroom. Is it really... The word physically present, I think you can look at that situation and say he was physically present.
What about a trial on with the defendant and prosecutor and defense counsel in one county mm-hmm. and the judge in another?
I am not sure, but I think that the defendant's presence at trial is probably constitutionally required.
Well,
then he, you know, is obstreperous.
That's right. There are always exceptions. But then we're going to have a different statutory. This is statutory. Now, we're going to interpret a statutory right, thinking about the Constitution, of course, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't want to interpret a statute in an unconstitutional way. So what I hear the state saying is that we're going to have different definitions of present for A through G, possibly.
Possibly, I can't.
What about an evidentiary hearing? Different definition? Can you have them in different counties, like here?
I think under the statute, I think that would be okay. I mean, there might be constitutional problems about whether that satisfied the Confrontation Clause, but I think that would be okay.
Veneman says no. In an evidentiary hearing, raising facts, it's got to be physically present, citing Hatch and United States v. Harmon. I mean, my problem is, do we want to interpret 97104 where present means different things under A, B, C, D, E, F, G? Maybe we do, or H, too. Or do you need one definition of presence for all?
I think you can have one definition of presence for all, and that you could...
What is it?
Well, it would include, as I said, don't really know what the word is, but we're all, let's say single courtroom presence. That would be a good phrase. That presence can mean single courtroom presence, and it can also mean video conferenced presence. Of course, I'm most comfortable with courtroom-to-courtroom video conference presence. I think the tricky thing is when we get out, well, of course, that wouldn't apply to a view by the jury. I think that it's okay to interpret physical presence that way for two reasons. One is any time that the... interest was a constitutional interest, the Constitution would preclude the physical, the video conference procedure, maybe, so that would be okay. And on the other hand, we have to remember that we are requiring the defendant's consent in all of these situations. And that this is not anything that can be imposed on the defendant involuntarily. The defendant consents to these things, and as I just said, you know, the class of defendants can be very much benefited by the ability to be present by video conference.
Is the consent forfeit or waiver? Standard.
I believe Justice Crook said it's a hybrid sort of situation, and I think it is. I think it's basically, it's a statutory interest with, and I think... Fundamentally, it seems like a forfeiture situation. The reason I think that it's a waiver, but not one that requires a formal waiver colloquy, is because the 885-62A, this was something I wanted to emphasize, uses the word entitled and says that the defendant is entitled to be physically present at these various proceedings, and to me, entitled means he gets to choose and that choice should be made affirmatively. I did listen to the court's hearings on this rule, from which I inferred that the court imagined that guilty pleas could be entered through video conferencing, but it would only come with defense consent. And I really felt that to the extent this was being allowed, it was absolutely conditioned on consent, which is why I think it's with Justice Crooks, I think it's a waiver. And I'm out of time, but I'm happy to answer, like, the Koopman's question and anything else.
All right. And I'll ask you the Koopman question.
Okay.
Yeah, let me ask the Koopman question.
All right, Chief, go ahead.
That was my question. And my question on Koopman got back to this 885 and what you can do with 885 since 751-12 says there can't be any modification of substantive law. I really read your brief as saying, because it says it, on page 23, that the Koopman rule is not workable in the post-885-60 courtroom. Mm-hmm. And I think that means, as I read it, that it post-885-60, that Koopman is either no longer good law, or you got to get out of, since it's not workable with 885, you got to distinguish it. That's the way that I read your brief.
I lost my brief. Okay. Well... it may say this elsewhere, but I would add the hyphenated adjective, the absolute anti-waiver Koopman's rule is not workable in this, in our
because
new...
Because of 885, you say.
And
yeah,
in our new
setting.
Yeah, well, I'm going to answer.
Okay.
And Koopman's is a situation of bad facts making bad law, I think. I mean, they're horrendous facts, and we all understand what they are. I think that Koopman's can be harmonized in one of three ways. And I feel that the Chief Justice was saying something or leading to something like this. First of all, before the clarification of the difference between waiver and forfeiture, I think Koopmans used the waiver languages, but really Koopmans was a forfeiture case. The defendant didn't show up. And that we can narrow Koopmans to say that a defendant may not simply forfeit her right to be present at a 97-1041 proceeding by not showing up. She must voluntarily waive it on the record, as Soto did here, albeit not through a formal waiver colloquy, but it was a clear and specific waiver. So that's one way that Koopmans can be harmonized, just by saying it's a forfeiture case. Second, the cases can be harmonized by saying that a defendant may not voluntarily waive or forfeit, now I'm using both words, hedging my bet, her right to be present under Section 97-1041, unless allowed to do so under another rule or statute, such as 967-08 or 885-60. Third, the absolute anti-waiver rule of Koopmans should be held applicable only to cases of complete and unambiguous absence, whereas here the defendant's presence by videoconference is, in the words of Peters or Judge Hoover, the legal equivalent of physical presence. The Koopmans rule does not apply. But finally, and I think that the court can harmonize the case in all three or two or one of those cases, and if it can't, then I think Koopmans should be overruled, because I think it is an extreme decision. I mean, that was a constructive, I mean, it wasn't even like, it was beyond forfeiture because it was a constructive forfeiture. You know, was she thinking, the country, and that way I won't have to go to my sentencing hearing. She probably had a bigger picture there.
So the answer to the question, do any of the cases have to be tweaked? The answer is yes.
Yes.
Koopman, at least, and Veneman probably, too, has to be tweaked or overruled.
Well, Veneman, I think, tweaking at most. I don't think Veneman has to be overruled.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Harvey, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. The state's argument is troubling to me for a couple reasons. In my personal opinion, what the state is asking us to do is to take very clear law and to muddy the waters. Koopmans has a clear, bright-line rule. Waiver is not permitted. Veneman has a clear, bright-line rule. Physical or presence means physical presence. If we say we need a special exception for guilty plea hearings or only if the defendant is completely physically absent, we make it confusing for courts. Right now, it's simple, it's straightforward. It tells the trial courts what to do and how to do it. And if we change that, you know, it's going to reduce the judicial efficiency here, and we're going to be seeing a lot more appeals. There's two things I want to briefly touch on, if my time allows. First, I want to come back to this issue of waiver, and what do we do if this court decides that Koopman's rule prohibiting waiver absolutely is a little too extreme. And secondly, I want to come back to harmless error, since I ran out of time on that point before. In my opinion, my position in regard to waiver is twofold. First, that the waiver, if waiver is permitted, the record in this case certainly is not sufficient to prove that it was knowing and voluntary. And second, that if waiver is permitted, it absolutely does need to be knowing and involuntary. This is a case that involved a guilty plea hearing. It's not a misdemeanor proceeding. It's not an arraignment. It's not a bail hearing. This is the decisive moment for Mr. Soto, the moment he chose to relinquish his right to a trial, to plead guilty, to admit the underlying facts, to subject himself to the punishment of the court, and face the ultimate loss of liberty. The ultimate result of the guilty plea hearing is the same as the result of a guilty conviction at the trial. You know, it doesn't get any more serious than this. So it follows then that physical presence of both the defendant and the judge in the same location is crucial to the appearance and reality of a fair and just proceeding. I've got additional concerns about the use of video conferencing that goes beyond, you know, what the defendant may be entitled to or what this procedure demands. We've got to think about the right to the public trial, and we also have to think about the rights of the victim. Usually when video conferencing technology is used, it enables the defendant and the judge to see one another. From my own experience in Wisconsin courts, there's rarely sufficient equipment to allow the defendant to see any members of the public, the media. If there's other people in the courtroom, the defendant and sometimes even the judge don't get to see it. So public attendees, you know, media members like the attorneys, have to decide, is it more important to be in the same location as the judge or is it more important to be with the defendant? I think that the victim also has got a right to this face-to-face dialogue and assessment that occurs between the defendant and the judge. Where they're not together and not present, the victim might think, my rights aren't being taken seriously. This hearing isn't being taken seriously. So Koopmans helps eliminate all of those complications by creating that bright-line rule.
Could I ask you, counsel, do you know of other cases in which a guilty or no contest plea was entered by video conferencing?
I have researched some cases. I apologize, I don't know their names offhand. I do know...
What I'm really trying to get at is what the consequences would be if you prevail. We've made very strong arguments here. And how is this going to open up every guilty plea that has been taken by video conferencing?
I'm not, in my personal opinion, the deadlines for previous appeals would certainly be passed, and so it wouldn't necessarily open the door to reexamine those. I don't think that this is a common practice in Wisconsin. I think this circumstance is a little bit rare, and so when we're talking about clarifying the rule in terms of making it more possible to do that, it isn't really happening anyway, except in a few other rare circumstances. And so it seems to me that most courts are already interpreting this as requiring the defendant's physical presence, requiring the defendant and the judge to be in the same location for the guilty plea hearing. I do want to quickly return to the issue of harmless error. My position towards harmless error is actually twofold. As I alluded to in my brief, I think that we could classify the error in this case as actually a structural error, and there's three reasons why I think that should be the case. I see my red light is on. Can I?
Very, very quickly.
So there's three things that the court can look at to determine whether or not it's structural error. First, whether the error is overarching and affects the framework of the proceeding. Second, whether the harm can actually be identified and measured. And third, whether a meaningful remedy can be crafted. I think this case fits all three. First of all, an individual is either present or they're not. There's no in-between. So the harm is very overarching. It taints the entire framework of the proceeding. Second, I think there are harms inherent in the use of video conferencing. Those are in my brief. I've only delved into one of them now. And I don't think I'll have time to do it now. But these are very difficult to detect and measure. So requiring a harmless error analysis would be a mere exercise in rhetoric, because the state would never be able to meet its burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the complete absence of these harms. And third, a remedy other than reversal would be very difficult to craft in this situation. It's not like a situation where we sentence on inaccurate information. There we can go back and say, you get a new sentencing hearing, because only the sentence is tainted, not the entire framework in which the conviction was arrived at. In our case, the whole validity of the guilty plea is compromised.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court has and will reread your brief on the issue of harmless error. I want to thank you, Ms. Harvey, and you, Ms. Whalen, for your excellent arguments today on case involving video conferencing. I think it may be one of our only or very few cases that involve video conferencing, although we have had similar cases as to teleconferencing. And as both of you note, this is under the court rule, but that a statute has amended the video conferencing and may raise different issues, which we need not face in this particular case. So I want to thank you both, and that concludes our hearing on 10AP2273CR, State versus Soto. I believe we have some students coming in, so the court will take a brief recess, so we may allow the students to come in. Thank you.